before we get started, can someone give me a heads up on the sound? Can you just make sure my mic is working all right? Okay, good. I was working on my pulling the string a little bit tighter on my tin can, and it looks like I have it just the right tightness. I had to make sure the windmill pulled the string tight enough so we can broadcast properly. Okay, very good, very good. Shalom and good Shabbos to everyone. And welcome to the Beis Yaakov Hebraic Congregation Midrash. The scriptures for today is Genesis 12, 1 through 13, 18. The Haftorah is Joshua 24, 3 through 18. The ninth, the Psalm is Psalm 9, and Hebrews 11, 1 through 10. We read the scriptures earlier, and so we won't take time to read them now. Leading the Midrash for today is Bill Paphlis. And Bill, we will turn it over to you at this point.
All right, shalom everybody. This is a continuation of the history of Abram, or Abraham. The first thing here is, Yah said unto Abram. Now, I believe when Yah talks to somebody, he means business. And he wants you to listen up. So he said, Yah said unto Abram. Now, it pleased Yahweh, who has often been found of them who sought him not, and to reveal himself to Abraham, perhaps by a miracle. We're not told. And I believe that the conversation of Abraham is one of the most remarkable in Bible history. Because he said, get thee out of your country, and I'm going to take you to a place that you don't know, from away from your people. Just go. You know? Go there. Now, I believe that he was probably brought to the knowledge and worship of truth. Yahweh probably had given it to him sometime earlier. The time lapse, we do not know. Now, this call included two promises. The first showing the land of this future posterity, and the second, that in his posterity all the earth was to be blessed. And Abraham obeyed. Now, it is frequently mentioned in the Brit Hadashah as a striking incidence of his faith. You can go to Book of Hebrews 11, 8, and 9, being one of such scripture. Within these two verses is a sevenfold blessing tied to the sevenfold blessing in Exodus 6, 4 through 8. It shows the grace and goodness of Yahweh. Verses 4 through 6, Abraham did as Yahweh told him to do, being obedient. And I think that's the key word, is obedient. Taking Lot with him, along with his wife Sarai, and with others that went with him, into the land of Canaan, to a place called Shechem. This is the place of Abraham's first altar and Yahweh's first mission. If you go to John chapter 4, it was also Jacob's altar in 33:18. So it's not a place that just is mentioned in passing, because things happened there. And now here Yahweh states, unto thy seed will I give this land. Now Yah was dealing with Abraham not in his private and personal way that he would do, but with a view of the high and important interest in future ages, what was going to take place later. And this was to affect all mankind, physically as well as divinely. And it talks about Bethel. That was the next stop that they went. And there Abram built an altar, calling upon Yahweh's name. Again, Abraham moved further south to the, how do you say that? Negebi, the desert, the area. Nine. But it's not, it wasn't in nine. Negev. And now there was, it says that there was a famine in the land, and Abraham went down into Egypt. It is though, it is almost seems like that he forsook the promise in the land for a short time. But in his defense, I think Egypt at times was called the house of bread. And during hard times. Also of note is that he didn't go back to the land of his birth and those idle, loving people. He did not go there. You can go to Hebrews 11:15 deals with that. This portion of Scripture shows in verse 11 through 20 the human side of Abram. Inasmuch as we all have failed to trust Yah in something or all things, maybe. Abraham, in this instance, tells a half-truth about his sister or his wife, which is a lie, because Sarai was indeed a half-sister, but it was a deception. His conduct was culpable and inconsistent with the character as of a servant of Yahweh. It wasn't inconsistent with what he should have been doing. It showed a reliance on worldly policy more than a trust in the promise. And he did not only sin himself, but he tempted Sarai to sin also. I think his action was an attempt to Hassan's attempt to destroy the seed line. But Yah stands up against Hasatan by bringing plagues to Pharaoh's house. And Pharaoh sends him out of Egypt. Now, folks, does that sound familiar to you? That Pharaoh sent somebody out of Egypt? I think it has a familiar ring to it. Had not Yah interfered, he might have been tempted to stay in Egypt and forget the promise. Often, Yah still rebukes his people and reminds them through enemies that this world is not their rest, nor is it for their best. And I think these lessons are some that we need to take to heart when we study about the patriarchs. And sometimes, oh, this guy did this wrong, or this guy did this wrong, that wrong. How would we like to have our life as an open book and put before the world and the generations upon generations to see? So that's what I have in the first part. There's a lot in there that I didn't cover that somebody else might have something they want to say.
Yeah, Bill touched on the idea that the Abraham going into Egypt and being thrown out was a type of what Israel was going to do 400 years later. Abraham left a wealthy man after arriving as a pauper. Israel did the same thing. Notice that even the heathen, by the way, in verse 18, okay, even the heathen understood that it was evil to commit adultery in those days. Okay, I mean they had that idea. So how come we don't? You know, today I don't get that. Got an interesting thing here. As Abram was moving towards Egypt, he was going down out of Israel, down away from Jerusalem and towards Egypt. Where did he pitch his tent? He pitched his tent on the east of Bethel, Bethel on the west and Hai on the east. And there he built an altar under Yahweh, and he called on the name of Yahweh, called that Bethel. We're going to see when he comes out in chapter 13 that he pitches his tent in exactly the same place. Only he's facing in a different direction. He's not facing away from Israel. He's facing towards Israel. And there's a There's a spiritual lesson to be seen there, and we'll see that in a little bit.
You know, when we read through the Torah portions each week, whether you're reading the annual portion or the triennial portion, the portions will always go along with what's happening in the feast cycle. And we see that a little bit here in Genesis 12 and 13. And in 12, we see at the very beginning, the Lord saying to Abram. In other words, the Lord's about to tell Abram, here's what I'm going to do for you. He says, if you go forth from your country, then he says, I will show you the land. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And in you, I will bless all the families of the earth. God is saying to Abraham, do you choose me? Here's what I'm willing to do for you. This is my ketubah, my marriage agreement with you, Abraham, and with your family. I choose you to be the progenitor of the Hebrew people. But here's what I will do for you. That's the neat thing about the ketubah, the original thing with the ketubah, the marriage contract. It wasn't the prenups as we know them today of what do you get if this doesn't work, planning that it won't work. It's the husband's agreement of taking care of the bride and the children, if there are any. So this is what God is saying. And we see in verse 4, Abram went forth. That's the Shavuot message. You've come to a point now, you're face to face with God. God says, here was what I will do for you. Do you choose me? You know, when we go back to Shavuot in the wilderness, or from Genesis, when we go forward to Shavuot in the wilderness, we see this when the Lord descends on Mount Sinai, and through Moses he says, here's what I want to do for you. I chose you. I've redeemed you. Do you choose me? And that's one of the lessons we need to learn each and every Shavuot as we celebrate Shavuot tomorrow, is the Lord is giving us His word, His promises. He's calling us out. Will we choose Him? And the only correct answer, which we see later on in the Haftarah portion today in Joshua, is choose this day whom you will serve. Choose this day. On Shavuot, we need to choose whom will we serve. If it's yes, Lord, then we need to do as Abram did, and we need to go forth as Yahweh speaks. And as Mark pointed out, the place where he camps is Bethel, the house of God, at which point we begin to camp and dwell in Bethel, the house of God.
I think it's interesting, and I missed this, so I just looked at it. It doesn't say that he was 75 years old, does it? It says 7 and 5. 5 is divine grace, and 7 denotes spiritual perfection. So as he was leaving, he had the divine grace of Yahweh upon him, and he had divine perfection because Yahweh was with him wholeheartedly in this junction.
Yeah, when you pick it at it like that, you see 70 as in 70 nations of the world, and 5 is in the grace of Elohim. So, yeah, that's cool.
Just kind of a quick question. Abraham was kind of deceitful in dealing with Pharaoh when it came to come to Sarai in, 13, 14, 15, 16, and was paid for his wife. But in the end, for being his deceit, he was actually rewarded because he actually went away from Egypt with all kinds of sheep and cattle and oxen and maidservants. So I guess my question is, why was he rewarded for being deceitful with Pharaoh?
Couple of things. One, God had just told him, those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. So in a way, Pharaoh cursed Abram by taking Sarai. And as a result, Pharaoh was cursed, and a lot of his wealth went with Abram and Sarai when they left. Now, as far as Abram lying about who Sarai was, we do have the Torah. One, he wasn't lying because she was his sister. But two, he was being deceitful. But we are told in Torah that there's one instance where lying is okay, and that's where they're going to pervert justice. if the enemy will pervert justice, then it's okay to lie to the enemy. That's the one stipulation on truth.
Yeah, that's true. But it seems that Pharaoh was pretty honest in his dealings, and he wasn't being... He took Sarai in, you know...
Integrity
of Sarah was not bad.
Which is why, exactly, Sharissa said it, and it's true, which is why Yahweh didn't strike him dead. But I think that it all happened to bear the type of Israel going into Egypt, and Israel went away from Yahweh when they did that, and they came out with superabundance, because they finally said, well, we'll call on him. You know, and when they did, he heard them. So I think that's the point, is to give you an ensample of what is going to come. And then we have the exodus from Egypt of the entire nation as an ensample of what's to come to us. So it's way cool. Yeah. I mean, he shows us that stuff in advance. It's how he tells the end from the beginning.
See, that it's part of the thing when you study this and you say, why would that happen? Just like your question was. But when you study it, the richness comes out of that. Sometimes some of the secrets that's in the Word we can have understanding of, whereas other times we still don't have the understanding that we hope in the by and by that He will give us the total understanding of His Word. Because in truth, even if we've been studying for 40 or 50 years, that we're still ignorant of all of His ways, and we don't truly understand. But it is a blessing when we do learn. That's the fun part about it, when you study and say, aha, this is something that I've learned. And if you are a person who thinks they read the Bible through once and you know it all, then you're not going to learn anything. But that's the effect of the Word should have on you, to be able to want to dig and search the more. I don't know if anybody out in Pal Talk has anything, or anybody else want to interject. Yeah.
Okay to lie if... justice is...
She's looking up the cross reference now.
She's looking it up right now.
Yeah. Yeah, the midwives in Egypt lied about the young male Hebrews, and the Rahab lied about the spies. I mean, the lying in itself, bearing false witness, is about bearing false witness in a judicial proceeding, especially in one that has to do with someone's life or death. Okay? If you bear false witness against somebody, that's the only time in a judicial proceeding, if you bear false witness against somebody and it's found out, then you get to have the penalty that would have gone to the guy because of your false witness. Okay?
I've got the cross-reference
but,
mark.
That's bearing false witness. Okay? That's not about... using deceit. Go ahead, use it.
In Exodus 23, and starting in verse 1, it says, "You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute." In other words, if you know that when you bear the truth, the truth in your witness, that it will pervert justice, you do not do it. You don't do it even if everyone else is doing it. In other words, if the feds come knocking on my door and say, "Where's Mark Patron?" Well, I know Mark Patron, and I know why the feds would be asking, because, you know, we've
been
here at Beit Yaakov.
Just call me and warn me.
They're saying, "Call me and warn me." No, I don't tell them, because I know that in this case, what the feds want is not justice. So that's, you know, any other time, Mark, I would tell
somebody.
How
would somebody, you know?
It's the feds.
Okay. Ray has a question.
Yeah, it's a comment concerning that. It's out of Exodus chapter 1 about the Hebrew women. But the midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, Why have ye done this thing and have saved the men children alive? And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty.
Exactly right. In that case, they were actually bearing false witness, to be specifically. I mean, they were telling a lie in order to cover themselves. But in the meanwhile, Yahweh said, that was good, because you saved my people. And you prospered them. That's right. I got something on verse 3. I will bless them that bless thee, and I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. In other words, the nations that bless you, I'm going to bless. The person who curses you will be cursed. Okay? So that's the way I read that anyway. And I have a question. Is this a spiritual blessing or a physical blessing? And which was it that Abraham was looking for? Ooh, Tom is going, ooh.
I think it's both, because it ties in with the comment I was going to make. In verse 3, we have, in you,
which was he looking for?
The spiritual and physical. In 3, we have, and in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Mm-hmm. The word there actually, it's blessed to prosper, but it's also intermingled or grafted. Mm-hmm. I believe Yahweh was referring to spiritual and physical blessing.
Okay, that answers that part of the question. The other question is, was Abram at this particular time, was he looking for the spiritual blessing or was he looking for the physical blessing?
Yes
may be the answer, but I think that yes is the answer in 15, chapter 15, where he believes Yahweh and it's accounted unto him for righteousness. Here he believed Yahweh because it was something really good for him. You know, I think he was. I think here he was looking at a with his physical eyes. He wasn't working on faith at the time.
Well, we know,
and I think we can see that in the fact that he leaves here and goes down to Egypt.
And we know that, Mark, from Hebrews, where it says he was looking for the city.
Right.
So he was looking for a physical city, even though
whose builder and maker is Yah.
So right.
He's looking for something beyond. Yeah, not made with hands.
Correct. But it's a physical city, but made by God. It's above and beyond what man can create, which is spiritual, of course, because it's made by Yah, but it's physical in that it is a city.
Exactly. But the point I'm trying to get to here is that at this particular time, right here in chapter 12, Abram was not acting in faith. He was acting by sight. It was after he gets through the deal in Egypt that he starts to act in faith. And it's only after that, and he slips again by going into Hagar in chapter 14. And we have Ishmael, you know, and all of that. It's not until chapter 15 when he gets the promise and the circumcision so that he can see a physical evidence that the promise will be. That's when he starts working in faith. And that's when Yahweh says, he accounts it to him for righteousness. He's justified in chapter 15. He's not justified at this time, the way I read this. In other words, that's my opinion. If you don't agree with me, it's okay. Yahweh will show you where you're wrong.
And having said that, and that is most likely true, he may not be justified, but he is the called of God.
Yes, absolutely.
I wanted to comment on verse 7. We have Yahweh appeared to Abram. and said, to your descendants I will give this land. So many people do not realize that we are part of that promise, that we are the descendants. And I would refer to Galatians 3, verses 7 and 8, just briefly. We are descendants of Abraham. All who come by faith are the seed of Abraham. In Galatians 3, 7 and 8, we have, therefore, be sure that it is those who are faith who are sons of Abraham. The Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, all the nations will be blessed in you. So we have there the exact parallel to this. And it's, I believe it's physical and spiritual.
The gospel was preached to Abraham, mm-hmm. that all of the nations would be blessed in him. That's the gospel. Mm-hmm. Is that a different gospel than the everlasting gospel in Revelation? Or there's only one gospel, isn't there? One good news. And the whole idea is there's going to be peace between Elohim and his people. And everything will be echad. Not absolute unity or absolute oneness, but unity. Echad.
And we see later on, we're not there yet, we'll be there in a few weeks, but later on in Genesis, when Abraham finally has Isaac, when Sarai gives birth to Isaac, and he's told to take him up on the mount and to offer him up, we see how that will come about.
Yeah.
So the whole gospel is preached to and through Abraham and what's going on here in Genesis. Because exactly as Mark just said, it's about the land, it's about unity, it's about keeping the family together and reuniting it. At the same time, it's how it will happen.
I sort of find it interesting that the Canaanites were already there in the land. And I think it's probably evident from Terah's and Abraham's call that Satan already knew the line by which the seed of woman was coming into the world. You know, from 3:5, talks about that in 3:5. In chapter 6, Satan aimed at the whole human race. But now he aims at Abraham and his land. And so this is the second explanation of the words after that in verse 6:4. This is what's taking place here. Meaning Hasatan, preoccupies the territory ready in dispute in advance of those who were coming, trying to destroy the seed line. But the prodigy of a later attempt to corrupt the race had to be destroyed by the sword of Israel, as those in the days of Noah had been by the flood. So this war that started in the garden is very prevalent here, basically in an open forum, where I think the closer we get to the in that day, it's more subtle and it's more hidden, that people can't see it. Hasatan has learned a lot of in their behavior over the years.
It's more hidden to the vast majority of people. It's out, right out in the open for those who have some spiritual discernment.
And that only comes because we study Torah. Without the study of Torah, I can, after teaching 30-some years in the Baptist Church, that I didn't understand the concept.
I knew there was something.
See? and I do have, at least I have a little understanding now of the workings of Hasatan through the Torah, that Yahweh takes the evilness and turns it into good, and he'll turn things around, as we'll be able to see in Scripture here. For his good, and he'll use that evil for good, and sometimes for judgment. You see, he does that, and out of the evil that, or the error that caused by Abram, he came out of there with a whole parcel of silver and gold and cattle and whatever. He says, just leave, because for some reason Pharaoh knew this man was a man of God, a man of Yahweh. And he just says, The faster I can get them out here, the better it is. But something happened in that household that was not good. You know, so this is where Hasatan can have a field day if he's let go.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else in Pal Talk? Okay. In verse 8, we see the names of the two towns, right? Bethel he has on his west, and Ai he has on his right, on his east, and he's headed south. So Bethel's on the left, Ai's on the right. Bethel means house of God. We know that. Ai means a ruinous heap. And so what he's got is a ruinous heap on his right hand, which should be the blessed hand. But what he's got on that side is a ruinous heap. And on the left hand, that's the also-ran, that's the house of God. The also-ran. That's the best I can do for you right now. I can't come up with... I mean, the power is on the right. The power is not on the left. And so Abraham's power as he's going into Egypt is Ai, the ruinous heap. And he goes into Ai, into Egypt, rather, broke, pretty much. He's carrying. He's not an exceptionally rich man. But when he leaves, he's got all kinds of stuff. He's very rich. He plunders Egypt in a way, and it's a perfect picture of Israel coming out. About ready to move on to chapter 13. Anybody else got anything else on chapter 12?
Chapter 13. Now we have an ascend instead of a descend. It says, Abram went up. Not only was it a physical ascent, but I believe because of what transpired in Egypt, it must have been a spiritual one as well. In his journeys, he again stopped at Bethel as at the beginning. The thought here could be that sometimes it is needful to start over at the beginning to get it right. Maybe this was, maybe this was his effort to do that. It says, unto the place of the altar. Now, where he called on the name of Yahweh, you will notice there was no mention of worship in Egypt, i.e. the world. This was a good lesson for us to keep on keeping on for Yeshua. If you go into the world, you will not have that altar built. You will not keep the things of Yahweh. Can't mix it. It's impossible to do. So I think this is a good lesson for us to learn. That if you're going into the world and you think you're going to play games, it's not going to happen because you're going to lose. You see, the blessing won't be there from Yahweh because you're out of sorts with Him. And He's going to leave you. He's going to let you to your own devices. And I think that's exactly what happened to Abrams here. One cannot stay in the world and worship Yah. Granted, the world has much to offer, it seems, but a famine from the Word is the downside, and it doesn't even out of how we're supposed to be. And this all plays out in verses 6 through 13. As Abram and Lot had much of in flock and herds, plus tents, it became very apparent the land could not hold them both, meaning Lot and Abram. A contention broke out among the herdsmen. Abraham finds a solution. With the whole land before us, whichever way you choose, I will go the other. Lot sees, that's one of the three temptations. Lot sees the plains of Jordan with much water, choosing it, and pitches it, his tent towards Sodom. He's pitching it in the wrong direction, i.e. a type of the world. For Sodom was wicked exceedingly before Yahweh. A difference here, two equals a difference here. It deals with the hearts, I believe it deals with the hearts of Abram and also deals with the hearts of Lot here. It seems Lot being a good man, Lot had fallen under the influence of a selfish and covetous spirit. This can only lead to perils and tribulation without the protection of Yahweh. And we know somewhat what happened to Lot in this. And I believe it really does show the heart of Abram that he was now trusting Yah. He said, whatever way you want to go. He could have looked here and he saw that. He says, you take whatever you want, and I'll take second best. But second best was really first if he was following after Yahweh, and he was doing what Yahweh wanted him to do. So this plays out. And Mark, you had something about the direction at Bethel?
Yeah.
You want to say something about that?
Yeah, on his way back out of Egypt, now when he stops and pitches, he pitches his tent. He's moving northwards, and he pitches his tent. Let's see, in verse 3 it says, "And he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai." Now he's moving from the south, and he's got Bethel on his right and Hai on his left. And so he's left the ruinous heap, and he is now living in the with the Bethel as his power. Okay, the house of Elohim is his power. So between the time that he was going down to Egypt, or rather in the time that he was in Egypt, he had a change of mind. And now he's moving in Yahweh's, at least more in Yahweh's will.
I think it's interesting that the name Lot means veil. That it was just like there was a veil put over him to see the truth of Yahweh, and he paid for it with a great lesson, as we'll find out later on in Scripture. You cannot play around with Yahweh. He is very seriously when he calls you, and he wants you. That's what he wants. It doesn't mean that we're going to be perfect, because surely these men and these women were not perfect here in the Word. But I believe they tried whatever was within them to be obedient most of the time. And if they were corrected, Yahweh corrected them. And if they were at the right time, if they had the right stuff, then they turned back to Him. They turned back to Him with the right stuff. And a lot of times some of them didn't. They failed, and they died along the way. The people come out of the Exodus, they didn't have the right stuff. There was only a couple of them that did have the right stuff. And they went into the promised land. So, if that's the case, the scenario could be all Christians were going to be there in the Messianic age. I beg to differ with that, because I think Yahweh's going to choose the people that had the right stuff. And the right stuff starts with Torah and the festivals.
You mean overcomers?
Overcomers. The barley bride that people probably don't understand. That's a whole other lesson in itself, to be the first fruit. And barley was a first fruit. And that's what he wants us to be. He wants to be able to take us easily and to work us as he does the barley. Well, you can't do that with the grapes, or you can't do that with the wheat. One is thrashed and the other is stomped on, where the barley is not. It's just thrown up in the wind. The ruach separates it. You know, it's not taken, like Patricia said, it's not taken away on the wind of doctrine of sorts.
The chaff is blown away. That's right, the chaff gets raptured. There you go. Okay, we're talking about Lot again. Verses, we're down in 8 and following. We're talking about Lot. Let's start in 2 Peter, where Peter talks about Lot. And he says, 2 Peter chapter 2, and starting in verse 6. "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that should live ungodly, and delivered just Lot." That doesn't mean that he only delivered Lot, although he did. It means that Lot was just. "And delivered just Lot, vision of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them, and seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds." So what we have here is Lot is vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. There is a progression that starts in chapter 13 of Genesis of Lot being vexed. And we'll see that beginning in verse
8. And Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. And if thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. And if thou wilt depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes, and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. The progression starts in verse 10, where he beholds the plain of Jordan. He sees it with his eyes. At this point, he begins the desensitizing process. Let's see. It's a six-step process, and it goes on through chapter 17, 18, 19. So at this point, Lot begins to walk by sight. Okay? In verse 11, it says, And Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan. Okay, so he saw it and it looked good to him. It looked better than the other. And he chose that. And they separated themselves from one another. And then in verse 12, And Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent towards Sodom. So, started by seeing it, then he chose it, then he started to live in the area with his tent pitched towards Sodom. Lust of the eyes and the pride of life are taken over. It's exactly right. And then if we move to chapter... on chapter 14 and verse 12, And they took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So now he's not just pitched in Sodom, he's actually dwelling in Sodom. And then we go to 19:1. And it says, And there came two angels to Sodom at even, and Lot sat in the gate of Sodom, which means that he was a city official. He was an elder of the city. And so he's gone from being alongside of Abraham. He sees the beauty of the plain. He chooses the beauty of the plain. He moves towards the city of Sodom. He pitches his tent towards Sodom. He moves into Sodom and becomes a leader of Sodom. And at that point, the angels are there to destroy Sodom. And the only guy that they pull out of there is Lot, the only just person in the town. And I don't know what would have happened, but I think it would have been a lot better had Lot chosen to go the other way. Okay? Which is the way that Abram went and eventually ends up being the patriarch, although he'd already been told that he was going to be that.
What you said is true. You said there were six steps that Lot took. Well, six is the number of man.
That's right.
It's the downward spiral. No, I don't think it was the... Well, yeah. A double six, 12 step. Yeah. But... You know, the lesson we can see here, the difference between the two, that it was only after Lot had left that he said, look eastward, look south, look north, look west. He said, I'm going to give you all this. This is what I'm going to do for you. He didn't do it at the time Lot was with him. He did it after he had left. The other occasion when the things were told to them was after Judas left, and the things that Yahweh had told unto the rest of the brethren that was in the upper room. He waited until after the evil one had left.
Yeah.
So there's lessons there too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I go to a discussion board sometimes. Okay, imagine that. I go to a discussion board sometimes at the name of the website is carm.org, carm.org. And they have a discussion board there where they just... Anyway, they put Messianic Judaism in amongst the religions with, let's see, what is it right above it is Jehovah's Witness, and right below it on the list is the Mormons. So they got Jehovah's Witnesses, Messianic Jews, Mormons. Okay, so anyway, it's a obviously a dispensationalist Christian website. However, there's some great discussion goes on there, and you learn a lot of stuff from these people. But there are a number of anti-missionary Jews that come into the Messianic thing, and they ask questions and stuff. And one of them was, Yeshua could not have been the Messiah. If he had been the Messiah, and he had, and it was prophesied in the Old Testament, or in the Tanakh, that he was going to die for the sins of the world, why is it that his disciples didn't understand that? Why didn't his disciples understand that? Well, the reason was, and I told them, I can't give you any other answer except for this, and you're not going to accept it because it comes from Paul. But Rav Shaul says in 1 Corinthians, I believe it's in chapter 6, I can't remember the exact quote, but anyway, it's, had the principalities known what Yeshua was going to do and what it would accomplish, they would have not crucified the Lord of glory. Okay? So, I told him, that's the reason. If even one of those guys had known what it was, Satan would have known it. And he would have done his best not to crucify the Messiah. Okay? So, anyway, we could use some help, by the way, on that Messianic board if anybody wants to get on there and it's really a lot of fun at times. But other people have better things to do with their lives. So
I think, Mark, what you said, you hit on something, and the fact that Yahweh hides even from those very elect some things so that Satan cannot find out the total plan because he doesn't know.
Right.
He only knows a portion of it.
He knows the general revelation. He knows the revelation of the Scripture.
Right.
And he knows what people can surmise.
Right, that's true.
And that's all he can know.
Like you said, had he known, it would have upset the fact.
Had the Talmudim known,
yeah,
Satan would have known.
That's
and
right.
Had he known, that would, I mean, because Judas was his guy.
Right.
Had he known, it would have stopped the it would have stopped the principalities from pushing for his crucifixion.
Also, when you talk about Judas, his act, I believe, was, well, if he's come to redeem the land and get these people out of here, this is one way that I can make it happen quicker. He did a disastrously thing, but it turned the other way around. The fact that had he done so, he was I believe that his thinking may have been, perverted though it was, that I can force Yeshua to become that king of kings, that one that's going to rid the land. And that wasn't in the cards because they didn't, and they still don't today understand Ben Joseph and Ben David. They don't understand the concept of how he came and why he came in the manner that he came. And I think a lot of so-called Christians today do not understand that everything, I think it was mentioned in our discussion that, I don't know if Teresa might have mentioned about, we try to hurry things, we try to do things on our own to make things happen, and I don't remember exactly how it was, and we can't, or we shouldn't outrun God and try to think that we're going to change history. We can't change history. History has to play itself out. And our job is to not to try to thwart the will of Yahweh. Our job is to obey the will of Yahweh in whatever He calls us to do. Whether it be we be the ones that do great things or little things, it doesn't really matter, you see, with Yahweh. Because there is no difference with Him. If you give a widow's mite and you've given your all, can't give more than that. And I think that's what He expects from all of us. He said, if I give you a cup of water in your hand, that's all I demand. Just let me have the cup of water. That's all I want from you. In other words, He wants all of us. That's what He wants. He wants the best of us.
In verse 14, and Yahweh said unto Abram, after that Lot had separated from him, lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward. I think that possibly Lot was a major spiritual drag on Abram, and that once they had separated, Yah could work more with Abram than he was able to while Lot was with him. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. My note in ink, which doesn't happen very often when I write my notes in my Bible margins, if I put it in ink, it's one that's for real. If Abe had settled in one place, his inheritance would have been small, very small indeed. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever, and I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, even shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it to thee. Then Abram removed his tent and came to dwell in the land of, in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto Yahweh. He had already told Abraham that wherever your foot lands, that's going to be yours. Hadn't he? So, yeah, exactly. Men, cover as much territory as you can, because wherever your foot goes, that's going to be yours. Now, notice he'd already been to Egypt.
Quite a tent sale.
Quite a tent sale, yeah. He'd already been to Egypt, so Egypt is already his. That's part of his inheritance. Okay? That's very interesting to me. Everywhere that Abram's foot landed, that would be his. He came from all the way over at Ur in the Chaldees, somewhere around the town of Basra in southern Iraq. Ur of the Chaldees, right. He came from there, and he went all the way as far as Egypt. So, and everywhere in between is his. And then some. So, yeah, it's pretty lot of territory that's his, if he'll just believe. And now that Lot is gone and out of his way, he's going to have an easier time with it.
I think it's interesting the fact that he only showed the whole of the land or perspective of the land to only a couple people. And this Abram being one and the other being Moses. He showed those patriarchs. This is it. This is what we have over here. And neither one got to live to see that day. But they had the faith believing in it. If Yahweh said it, then I believe it. And I think sometimes talking to people, well, this preacher said that, or that preacher said that this is going to happen in this year, and that person is going to happen this year, and it doesn't happen, then they lose faith. Yeah. We're not to be time setters. We can know a season that we're in, but we do not know the exact time. We cannot do that. We can't set time. Because everything is done in Yahweh's time, in His setting, and it's going to happen just like He wants it to happen, regardless of the fact of what we think or do. That's all I have there. Anybody else have anything else on those scriptures?
One more thing. You know, Abraham did own land in Canaan. He purchased the Cave of Machpelah, and he had some other places that were his. But, you know, he never lived in a house. He always lived in a tent. He was always ready at any moment to pick up stakes and go where Yah told him to go. And in other words, that's the way we ought to be too. Not transient, but ready. Ready to pick up and go. Is that liquid? Exactly.
Even in a sense, if you want a home, in your mindset, you better say, whatever I have to leave behind, it doesn't matter. It's only things. And that's the way I feel about it. You know, I don't care if I own a mansion up on a hill six stories high. It has no bearing upon what He has prepared for me. It's not even worth it to worry about it because it's going to be destroyed.
If Everything. You own property that you picked up legally and lawfully, even if it's taken away from you, I believe that Yah is going to give it back to you because He will honor His law. Will He flatten your land out for you? Nobody's going to give you the ability to walk it real easy.
You know what? I think that's scriptural because it talks about hinds feet in high places. I think that's scriptural.
Well, two things. One, what Mark was just saying, that he'll restore it. We see that in Joel, that at the time of restoration, he's going to restore everything that's been taken away.
Right.
He says, I will make up for you the years that the... Or, let me go back here. The early rain for your vindication, the grain, the vats overflowing, new wine and oil, he'll replace with the swarming locust, the creeping locust, the stripping locust, and the gnawing locust have all taken. So if you need to give it up for him, he will certainly give it back to you. But that's why what we were saying, what Mark was saying and what Bill were saying were about, you know, have it in your mindset that you're ready to go. Live that type of life. That's why Michael Rood teaches, you know, whatever you don't need to get through, get rid of now. Now, one way is to physically get rid of it. Remove it from your presence. And if it's something you can't, in your heart of hearts, you know when that day comes, you're going to linger for just a moment to think about it, get rid of it now because it's going to hold you back. If it's something that you know what, I could leave this right now and it wouldn't bother me one bit. Physically, you may not need to get rid of it, but know that it's not going with you. You need to have the mindset of, I can pick up right now. You know, that's one thing I like about your son over there, Daniel, Mark. Because when he stays at our house sometimes, he's got everything important to him in his duffel bag.
You like something about him?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Imagine that. But everything that Daniel cares about outside of his horse and his family, his parents and his siblings, everything that kid cares about will fit in his duffel bag. He's ready. He's more ready than probably the rest of us in this room. And that's a really neat thing. And when I look at him, I've thought about that for months now, since those Friday nights when he would stay at our house and we'd bring him here on Sabbath, is I need to get to that place where I can just pick up and
go.
He
does carry a mandolin now.
He carries a mandolin.
Oh, it does fit in his duffel
bag.
Yeah,
okay. It fits in his duffel bag, and you know he always had his little Mac with him. So he had everything important, and he was ready to go. But that's the mindset. That's what I'm trying to say, is the mindset we all need to be in, is if we can't carry it, we don't need it, we need to have the mindset of it can either go now or it can go then, but I'm not attached to it.
There's a conspiracy in the banking industry.
You're a nut.
In the banking industry to literally take over people's homes. And there's different kind of loan. I can't think of the kind of loan it is out there today that is a...
It's called adjustable rate mortgage.
It's adjustable rate mortgage. It's a reverse mortgage.
Reverse mortgages?
Which are bad, but
now,
there's all kinds of other types of things. You know, equity mortgages where they give you 125% of your home. You know, you're doomed if you do any of these three in my book.
They give you 125% of your equity. So in other words, all right, you've paid off like 30% of your $30,000 worth, and you own actually $30,000 worth of your home, and then you take a loan against the equity, the $30,000, and they'll loan you $50,000 on the 30. Oh man, you're in deep bondage.
You're in deep bondage that only by the grace of God you're ever getting out of.
Now there was an incident down the street from us, just about 5 minutes away from us, where a man had, his relatives had built upon their land a log house back up in. And the government or the banks came and took it away. They lost the house. You know the old saying, he who laughs most first laughs least last? There's never been any easement that you can get back to the property. It's dead square in the middle of no man's land. The only piece of property there is out there. They'd have to come in and out of there by helicopter. There was never written into agreement that there was even a road way back into it and back out of there. The people that took over the house can't even get to the house. The bank can't get back there. The bank can't do anything with the house at all. And they took it over in a scrupulous manner. And they're stuck with something. They got a white elephant for sure, because they cannot, no way, by law, they can't do anything about it. It's just sitting there now. It's been sitting there now for a year or so. And that's, sometimes things like that happen, and justice sometimes is served. They should have never lost the home, but it's the kind of loan that they had that is pretty hard to figure out some of those loans, because they have lawyers figure them out. But you see, if you're going to worry about your possessions and things like that, then you're going to be in trouble. I don't care what it is. I told my wife, I said, what are you going to do with the animals? She said, we'll probably just have to leave them and hope for the best, you know, because there's no way we can take that many. Of course, Levi could go with you, you know, say. the goats can manage on their own, that's for sure. I would let them out, that's for sure. But they would be able to manage. But the problem is that sometimes we can be so stuck in this world. See, that's what happened to Lot. Lot became so stuck in the world. Oh, man, look at that. Look at the water. Look at the plains. Look at that. Oh, look at the bright lights of the city, you see. And that is not what Yahweh wants. He wants you. I think Abraham got it right. He chose the better. He let Yahweh say, you know what? He chose that. This is what I have for you. The whole of the land belongs to you. And your posterity. That's a better deal, I think. That's a square deal that he got. That's all I have on that. Anybody else have anything? Anything on Palto? If nobody has anything else there, we need to go. Joshua. We'll go to the book of Joshua. Joshua. Yehoshua. 24. The last chapter in the book of Joshua. I believe this is the last warning given by this ancient leader. By now he's an old man. Remember, he came out of the Egypt bondage. He's telling them again of Yah's provision for Abraham, and for his seed, also of Moses, and the miracles in Egypt. This section right here is a Reader's Digest version, though it's not, you know, it's not the long drawn out one. In verse 6, there is a sentence missing after Egypt, but it's preserved in the ancient writings. It is this: and they became a great populace and mighty people and were afflicted by Egypt. The reason for this whole speech was said in verse 2, and they served other gods. See, there's the downfall. They served other gods. So Joshua, again, reminds them of Yahweh's help in defeating the enemy before them. He says, we didn't have anything to do with this. Yahweh did it for us. He said, and the thing, starting in verse 13, and he tells them here, that I give you the land, he said, which you did not labor for, and cities that you did not build, and crops that you didn't plant. This shows forth the provision that Yahweh is the provider, and that he did everything for them, that man didn't do it. He did not do it. Jehovah Jireh, the provider. Therefore, he says, fear Yahweh and serve him with your whole heart and mind in truth. In other words, in Torah. What truth is to his Torah. He says, don't go where your fathers went, serving other gods. And verse 15, I think, is one of the great verses in the Word. If it seems evil to serve Yah, choose whom you will serve. Those on the other side of the flood, or those in the land before you. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. I think that says volumes. Verse 16 and 18, the oath of the people in these verses seem sincere, but we know without faith works is dead. And how soon was that oath forsaken? Because we know from the scriptures of the things that happened there. And from the wording of Joshua, that he suspected that some were considering the fact that they were already into idolatry. Thus we have a repeating about the strange gods. I think he already knew. I think that the message that Yahweh gave him showed him. And that's what I basically have in those things. It's just he's trying to renew their faith in Yahweh, that they didn't do anything to deserve what they have, that it was only by the right hand. It was only by the right hand. But if you choose the people on the other side of the flood, or you choose those people before you in the land, I think it's going to be the left hand of fellowship, which isn't fellowship, that he's going to give them. And I think Teresa has something here.
Well, just going back to what I was referring to earlier about how this relates to Shavuot. You know, here you were just pointing out, Bill, that it says, if it's disagreeable in your sight to serve Yahweh, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve. Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard people say, you know, well, we're already serving him, we're redeemed. But a slave in bondage cannot choose who their taskmaster is. You cannot choose. You must be redeemed out of slavery before you can choose. So you're redeemed out of slavery at Passover. You're brought to the mountain. And now, as a free individual, you can say to them, choose this day whom you will serve. Because otherwise, it's not a choice. Pharaoh could have asked them this, and there's only one answer, Pharaoh. But only after you are redeemed can you make that choice. That's why we see those in the body who are just walking along thinking they got their fire insurance, their get-out-of-hell-free card, whatever they want to call it. You know, do not pass go, do not collect $200, or in some cases they're passing go and collecting $200. But, or will we serve him? But that's the choice we have to make. That's why coming to Shavuot is so important. He's redeemed us. We've celebrated Passover. We've kept Passover. Now, will we serve him? Will we continue to walk the walk? Will we serve him?
I went a little further than verse 18. And I went to verses 19, 20, 21. And I love verse 22. Anyway, check this out. In verse 18, they said, therefore we also serve Yahweh, for he is our God. And then verse 19, Yehoshua says, you cannot serve Yah, for he is an holy Elohim. He is a jealous Elohim. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. If you forsake Yahweh and serve other gods, then he will turn and do you hurt and consume you after that he hath done you good. And the people said unto Yehoshua, nay, but we will serve Yahweh. And Yehoshua said unto the people, ye are witnesses against yourselves. You just waived your Fifth Amendment rights, buddy. All right? You just witnessed against yourself. You said you're going to serve Yahweh. You said it twice. Now, you've said it twice now. I gave you an opportunity to back off, but you said it twice now. Now, if you go after other gods, you're out of luck. Okay? You've witnessed against yourself. That's a very heavy thing. They just waived their Fifth Amendment rights. You've incriminated yourselves. Be careful to follow the way of Yahweh. That's what he just said. You have incriminated yourself. Be careful to follow the way of Yahweh. And what did they do? As soon as Joshua was dead, they started going after other people, after other gods.
Which is why it's so important to remember, as we're taught in the Brit Hadashah, to count the cost. Yeah. Know what it's going to take to get on this journey and finish this journey. And if you're not willing to pay the cost, don't say yes.
Oh, and by the way, the next verse, in verse 23, it says, put away from you these other gods. Mm-hmm. So they already had them.
They already had them. And that's the thing. Before we say yes to him, we need to clean out. You know, that was the thing. We accepted at Passover. We've been redeemed. We came out of Egypt. That's what we should have done back during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, is gotten rid of the foreign gods, gotten rid of the idols, gotten rid of the sin, so that when at Shavuot he says, choose this day whom you will serve, we could say yes with a clear conscience and not have those things that would pull us back down.
It is strange that later on down there he says that he took him at his word and he wrote in the book of the law. Not only did they say it, but he wrote it down. He wrote it down. One thing, if you are to be a bondservant, and you wanted to stay at the master's house, you had it all put in your ear. So here's what I wrote. If you choose the all, you will serve in awe of Yah. And that's exactly the way it is. When it talks about being a servant, the word truly is bondservant, one who follows Yah's law. You follow his Torah. And that's what he expects of us. He doesn't expect anything less of you than your all.
And that's a really good picture from the scriptures, Bill, of what I was saying about a slave can't choose who he's going to serve. In the case of the bondservant, when the awl was put through his ear on the doorframe, he's already been freed. He's free to leave. He's freed from his indentured servanthood to the one he sold himself to. But he says, no, I am free, but I choose to serve you. I choose to stay. And at that point, he is marked.
He is marked, and he gets to move into the Father's house. He's there forever in the Father's house. I think that's a beautiful picture of what he expects out of us.
In verse 1, it tells us where this is going on. Okay? Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel. Now look at Genesis chapter 35 and verse 4, real quick like. In Genesis 35 and verse 4, we have Jacob. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. Now run back over to Joshua chapter 24 and look at verse 26. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law and took a great stone and set it up there under an oak that was by the sanctuary of Yahweh, the same oak. Yeah, he's taken all... Okay, so not, the people have given up their... He writes the what the people just said. We're going to follow Yahweh. He wrote it down. He put it under a big rock, under the same oak tree with the idols that Jacob buried there. Isn't that something?
A little step further. What does it say in the next verse down there? Huh? What does it say about the stone? This stone shall be a witness unto us. The stone that the builders rejected, which is Yeshua, he is the witness unto us. It all fits, doesn't it? Huh? You know, sometimes you look at a word and you bypass it and you don't think until you really start digging in and studying it and to see.
Yeah, check this out. They would have had to throw the rock aside to get back to their pagan gods that they just gave up. The rock with a capital R. Okay?
That
once in a while even a blind squirrel gets an
egg. Yeah. Anybody else have any comment on Joshua? And what about on Palchok, Phil? Anybody comment? Surely you would think of some of this. There's great spiritual significance in a lot of these scriptures.
I'm not sure what the Bible
always
says. Once saved, always saved is not scriptural. That's how it fits. That's a falsehood that's been brought up through the church through the years. There's a difference between once, I'll make this very short and sweet. Once saved, always saved is a lie. Once saved, always saved says, I'm saved, now I can go do whatever I want. That is not God's way. What is God's way is eternal security. In other words, I come to him, he has redeemed me, just as I was saying. He redeemed me at Passover out of slavery. I got rid of the idols and the sins during unleavened bread. I've had time to work on these things, and now at Shavuot, he comes to me and he says, will you choose me? When you say yes and you continue to walk in that walk, we know it is Torah. He says we are eternally secure in him. Once saved, always saved, not good. Eternal security is scriptural, and they are two different creatures.
Well, there's an imbalance too of grace in the church, that it's just it's all grace and it's not obedience.
on the way down to my house there on 30, there's a place that says, "Yeah, are you tired of law, church law? Come here, we have grace." I have yet to see the pastor, but if I ever see a car there and think that he's there, I have some questions to ask him. I have some questions to ask this guy. You know, and the eternal security is different, of course, than what we're talking about here. And we have to understand something. The Bible says, working out our own salvation, fear and trembling. Well, and a lot of people take that the far end. You know, this is what you have to do. But I think what it means is, as we study Torah and we grow and mature in Him, then we grow in that eternal security of Him, and that, quote, salvation comes into view in a clear aspect of it. I could be wrong, but I think...
And you know, we were looking just a few minutes ago in Genesis 12 and 13 at Abraham. When God made covenant with Abraham, God made covenant with Himself. And He said, "I will keep this, Abraham. You are eternally secure because of Me." Right. He swore by one greater than Abraham. It's the same thing when we say, "Yes, Lord," like Abraham did. He says, "Now, Abraham, will you go?" And Abraham went. Same thing here. Will you serve Me? And we go and we serve Him and we keep serving Him. He's the one that makes sure we are secure. We don't have to do it. That's the difference.
Anyone in Palatine got a question or a comment? Are we done with the psalm? Anybody got anything? Oh, Tom's got his hand up.
One quick little thing here I noticed in verse 17. The way this is worded, it starts in 16. The people answered and said, "Far be it from us that we should forsake Yahweh to serve other gods. For Yahweh, our Elohim, is He who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage." That's exactly the way the listing of the Ten Commandments begins. That's the number one preemptive thing to remember with the commands is He is our Elohim who brought us out of bondage, out of slavery in Egypt.
But you have to keep going there, Tom, because it says, "And who did these great signs in our sight and preserved us." In other words, as the scripture says in another place, they knew the acts of God, but not the ways of God. And if all you know is the acts of God, you're going to fall away. We see it with Israel in the Tanakh. We see it happening in the church. We've got the church running from place to place looking for signs and wonders, the acts of God, but they don't know the ways of God. But in Deuteronomy, it says, "I will send prophets to test you who will have signs and wonders." But they're telling you not to keep Torah, and it's a test from the Lord to say, "Okay, you said you'll serve Me. Let's see." The acts of God are what He does. The ways of God are Torah. It's understanding His ways. It's understanding why He does something, not what He does. Correct. Because let's face it, He saved us. And the church today, as for the most part, and it's getting worse every week, and it just scares me, some of the things I hear and read. Mark says every hour, which is probably more true. The church today is teaching He saved us because it's about us, the church. The Bible says He saved us because it's about Him showing forth His name to the world. Why did He save us? The act is He saved us. The act is He redeemed us. The act is He's coming again to do certain things that He's promised. But the reason is to show forth His glory. He didn't save me because I was worthy. He didn't save me because... Well, it is the truth. I'll be the first to say it. I'm still not worthy.
You preach it, sister.
But having said that, I know He didn't do it because of me. He did it because of Him. You know, that's the thing. That's the problem with the pre-trib rapture. Right. Is the rapture is an act.
Right.
Okay? It's an act in more than one way. I know that I said that, I guess. But it's an act of God if it's to be true. Okay? But which brings God glory? The fact that snap our fingers, we're out of here, and God's glory is not seen, Because that means he did it for us. It's about us. Or is it that he is going to preserve us in the midst of, just like he did in Egypt, just like he did in the wilderness, just like he's done with Israel for all of these years, he preserves us in the midst of, and that shows forth the glory of God so that the world, the pagan world, will look on his people and say, there surely is a God in Israel. They're not going to look at Israel and say, oh, look at Israel, they're so blessed. They're going to look at us and say, surely there is a God. It's about him. It's why he did it. And we, if we don't know his Torah, if we don't walk in his ways, we will never know those things. And we'll get caught up in the same thing the church is doing today, saying it's all about me, 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 me.
One thing we know, if you think you can thwart the will of God, think twice that you can never thwart the plan. The plan is by the man, and he's going to make sure that it follows true. Exactly what it. He's the builder. He's the plan maker. It's going to follow out. He's the man. He is the man. Do we have anything else? It's going.
I just wanted to add that that verse that I mentioned, where they are quoting from the previous. Well, from they're quoting Exodus 20, the first verse. I believe in Hebraic thought, when they mention the first part of a verse like that, it brings to mind what follows. So this ties right in with their marriage covenant that they are agreeing to here. They are saying, yes, we will serve Yahweh. And it's bringing to mind all the other commandments there.
The problem with the covenant that they made was not done with white robes, because they were still following after. They were doing lip service. And lip service will not get it. It will not get it. It has to be a heart thing. And that, of course, is where Yahweh looks. He looks upon our hearts. And he doesn't care what you look like on the outside. You could have been so ugly when you were a baby, the mother fed you with a slingshot. He wouldn't care about that at all. He's only going to look at your heart. And that's all he cares about. Anything else? Anything on there, Phil? Okay. Well, we're moving good today. I don't know if that's good, but we're moving good. Psalm 9. Psalm, as Mark says. Psalm 9. I think in conjunction with 10 and a couple others flow the same way. But this psalm deals with the lawless one in part. A little overview. The psalmist praises Yah for deliverance from his enemies and celebrates the divine government for providing security to Yah's people and punishment to the wicked. That sort of covers basically the whole psalm. Now, verse 1 and 2, if you're going to go into battle, what should go first? Praise. Yeah. Praise should go first. And so that's what you have here. I will praise thee, O Yahweh, with my whole heart. He demands the whole and nothing less than that. It is the key. This is the key to all victory, is to praise him ahead of anything else that happens. And you'll see the words dealing with the other words of note that we see here in this psalm is fall, perish. This is to the unrighteous people. You'll see the word fall. You'll see the word perish. You see the word rebuke. You see the word destroy. You see the word judgment. And you see the word snare. Now, have you looked through Scripture and seen those that were unrighteous? And how many of these very words right here came forth. Judgment is falling upon the coastlines, and if it happens there, it happens here, because we're not immune from all of this, the things that are happening, and surely the judgments of Yahweh are going to come upon us. If you want to talk about tribulation and you think you're out of here, I think we're just on the fringe of it now, and we're going to be here. We're going to be here for it. Part in here is places where it says, sing praises unto Yahweh who lives in Zion. Sing praises unto him during this all. And he says that he will minister judgment to the people in uprightness. He's the only one who can do that in righteousness. The reason I brought this out is the fact that I see so much injustice in our court system today, that there is no black and white. It's contrary to what is supposed to be done. The judges are not righteous. The judges are picking and choosing who their enemy is, or examples are, and they're using these as in examples against the people. People that should be getting life terms or death are getting 18 to life, and they can get out in 18, 20 years.
But we know the court system was going to be corrupt. That's why God says, stay out of the court system. If your brother or sister takes you to court, deal with it, settle it outside of court. Don't go into the world system. When you go into their ballpark, you've got to play by their rules.
And not God only that, said, they're no, going to take not, you down.
Well, they're going to take
every
you
chance
down
they
because
can,
they're playing
you down
by your rules and their rules, and they're going to win because the rules are set up for them to win. But we need to remember that we are not part of that kingdom. We're part of God's kingdom. We're to stay out of the dealings of the false kingdoms. We're to stay out of their ballpark. We're not to go in and play games with them. That's why he specifically said, if someone's going to take you to court, even if it costs you, settle outside of court, because otherwise they're coming against you.
And it says, and they will get it from you to the last farthing. Boy, a farthing is like a hundredth of a pound in England. So it's like maybe 1.8 cents. They're going to get you right down to the penny. They're going to get every thing they can get out of you. And, I mean, that's just how it is. The judicial system of the world is the judicial system of Babylon, and it will absolutely work against you if you are a follower of Yahweh. If you're trying to do what Yahweh wants you to do, they're going to take you down. They're going to do their very best to take you down.
First,
don't go into their system if you can help it.
Verse 16 is pretty good because it says, Yahweh is known by the judgment which he executeth. In other words, he does it righteously. But the last part here is good. The wicked is snared in the works of their own hands. What did we just see back in Joshua? He says, well, we're going to obey. We're going to do this. He says, that's good. I'm going to put it right in the book of the law. You say, they were snared by their very own works and their words.
And their deceit came back to haunt them. Very quickly.
Yeah, in reference to Psalm 9 there, where Bill had pointed out like six different things that were going to happen to the wicked. One of the things was it says in verse 5 there, it says, put out their name forever and ever. And I always think of when the lady was caught in adultery, and Messiah says, any of you that are without sin, cast the first stone. Well, each one, starting with the eldest, they left Yeshua one by one, and he took his finger and started to write in the dirt, and that is in reference to Jeremiah, 18:13. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all that forsake thee shall be ashamed, and they that depart from me shall be written in the earth, because they have forsaken the Lord, the fountain of living waters. And I believe that's what that, him taking his finger and writing in the dirt was. They knew the scriptures, and that's what that was in reference to. And it says, put out their name forever and ever. So those that left Yeshua, that's what he was doing, went with his finger in the dirt. And then the woman that committed adultery said, my Lord, my God, she recognized him for who he was, but everybody else had left him.
If we don't have anything else, we'll go to Hebrews, the Brit Hadashah, chapter 11. Yes, it is. 1 through 10. It says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith. A long time ago when I was a pretty young Christian, I wrote, forsaking all, I trust Him. Forsaking all, I trust Him. That's what faith is. Believing. And there's more to it. But that's a start for it. Talks about the substance. Well, what is the substance? The substance to me was the promise of Yahweh, which we hope for. That's the hope we have in Him. As future and fulfillment, making them present in a reality, for reality to us. Even though it hasn't happened, in reality, we believe it has or it will happen. We have that substance, that promise that He has given us, that as we trust in Him, that this reality is with us and to us. So our faith is not limited to the here and now, but is included in the greater fulfillments. You say, if our faith only lasted to the here and now, it wouldn't be that much. But we have a greater thing to look for in the greater fulfillment. The evidence at all, means the demonstration. And has Yahweh demonstrated? Sure He has, down to the earth. It's convincing proof to the believer because of what He has demonstrated. And I believe that the soul is seeing what the eye cannot see. That you know within yourself what is truth and what isn't truth. Because you've seen a lot of miracles of Yahweh in people and things that happen. We were talking about different things happening, or this happening, that happening, like it was a coincidence. Of course, we were just kidding about that. There is no such thing as a coincidence. Everything happens for a reason and a matter. And if we believe that, then we have an understanding that Yahweh is in all of this. He is in everything that is going on. And it says, things not seen. Now, if we look back at some of the disciples, we had one that didn't see. So he didn't believe until he saw and touched. You see, the things not seen, it's the invisible and the spiritual world, the things that we do not see, that we cannot see, that we believe, we have that what the soul feels within you, that you believe that. And it's that you know that it's true. The witness, the Ruach will bear witness in our souls when it's truth and when it's not. So we know. Those outside of the faith are only going to go on their gut instinct, whether it's true or whether it's not true. And there is part of the reason that it's pretty hard to get through to people. You see, it's pretty hard to get through to those that are not believers unless you go to the right path. You can't feed them with all this stuff that we're learning. You have to feed them with the milk and let them let them learn by things like that. By keeping their faith, the fathers earned a good report, as if they were still living, by their testimony. By their testimony. For they ran the race as though they were under an easy yoke. And I believe, let me see here, what verifies that? 12:1. Wherefore, seeing ye also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sins which easily doth beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. So did these people, these fathers, the elders before, they had a good report. Why did they have a good report? Because they kept the faith, they ran the race. And that's what Paul was saying. You know, it might not have been perfect, but I did the best I could within the scope of what I have within my being, because I'm just a sinner saved by grace. And we do the best. We do the best that we can in the body that we have. Not only men, but Yah praised them. They praised them. Look at verse 3, 5, and 39. He praised them. Yah praised them. Why? Because they were faithful, basically, unto the end. They did what he wanted them to do within the framework of these bodies that we fight against the flesh. It says in verse 4 that Abel's excellent sacrifice was more than a burnt offering. I believe it was his obedience to the Father that showed forth his faith. He was obedient to the Father. He says, do this, and thus he did. He did what he was told to do. So with Enoch, his testimony, it says that he pleased Yah. He not seeing death. This is a here now but not yet picture. For in that day it will happen again. Some will not see death. It's a picture of what will happen. I believe the start of pleasing Yah is with faith that seeks him to please him. Then our rewards will be good ones. And this is our hope, that we will receive the promise and we will receive the rewards and the things that have been offered him. Verse 7 talks about also Noah moved by a reverent fear and a faith that Yah meant what he said. He said, build an ark. Okay. This warning was one of not yet seen. You know what? I bet he was mocked because he was the only guy on the block that had a boat. He's the only guy on the boat.
You know what? That reminds me of the Bill Cosby thing, you know? Oh. You know? I mean, what a great story. Yeah, right. What's an ark? Great story.
David, you have some?
Well, I think that in this world right now, we have a lot of evil and ignorant people teaching something else that faith is, which it's not. And what they teach faith is basically is some kind of spell you conjure up and you struggle, and then when you get this spell conjured up, then God has to do whatever you conjured up by your will and your effort. And that's not the right. And that has nothing to do with faith. And they even call themselves the ultra-faith movement, or I'm involved in the faith movement. It has nothing to do with faith whatsoever. Faith is not a magic spell. It's not anything like that. Faith is acting on the knowledge that you know that God knows what he's doing and you trust in him.
David, that was a perfect bridge between what Bill had been saying and what I wanted to share, because, you know, we saw back in Joshua, Mark went further down, and where Joshua says, but no, you can't serve God because you're going to turn away. And they said, no, we're going to. And he says, but your witness is against yourself. And then we saw how, you know, we were talking about how they knew the acts of God, but not the ways of God. We see this here, for he says in 11:6 of Hebrews, without faith it is impossible to please God. You know, and this faith movement that David was just speaking of over here is a faith movement that says, as long as he blesses me, as long as he delivers me from the jail cell, as long as he, you know, gives me the new Mercedes, as long as he gives me the 300 running shoes, as long as he gives me, because I've conjured up that magic spell, which is really what they're trying to do, then I'll trust him. But that's not what faith is. Without faith, it is impossible to please God, and faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith is believing in something you don't have. Faith is believing in something you can't feel, you can't touch, you can't hear. Faith is believing even when the miracle doesn't come, yet though he slay me, I will yet trust him. That's exactly what David was saying. That's what Job had to do. That's what Daniel had to do. That's what the three Hebrew children had. You know what, wicked king? You want to kill me, you go right ahead. My God is able to deliver me. But even if he doesn't, I am not bowing my knee, for I will yet trust him. That is faith.
That's right. And it's not something where it gives you the right to be in charge over God, and you tell God what to do. We are his servants. He is not our servant.
Let's get back.
Anybody want my handkerchief? Five of them.
Ray is trying to sell prayer handkerchiefs now.
And I said, will it work? It's not for me to say. Yeah. Now, this took place for 120 years. Now, it isn't like we're just going to go out and build and take a couple months or so, but it's 120 years this preparation took place. This really showed the faith that Noah had. While the world scorned him, I think that they did. He was a preacher of righteousness. And what did he preach? Preach Torah to them. Is what he did.
Remember something now. He didn't just have the only boat on the block. He had an aircraft carrier.
You're right.
That's how big that thing
is. That's right. It was huge.
And there ain't no ocean around.
And there had never been any rain. So when he just tells them build a boat, build the ark, I think Bill Cosby was right. He probably said, "Yeah, right, Lord. What's an ark? Yeah, what's an ark?" You have something, David?
Well, I was just thinking they have a children's movie out now with Tony Danza in it, where they build the ark and it's like the new ark. Only this time he gets it right. He lets everybody in the boat. You know.
This time he gets it right. He lets everybody in the boat. Okay, gotcha.
That's what society. That's
well,
how
you
they
see,
brainwash.
Society. That would be it. That's a truly merciful God. God. That's not merciful Yahweh. That's a merciful God. That's two syllables. God.
In verse 8 and 9, it deals with Abraham. It says that Abraham obeyed Yah. He went into a land he knew not and received it by faith. He being an heir to the promise as others who followed by faith. Sometimes the road is not an easy one, but our faith sustains us. In doing so, we become strangers to the world. Or we should. Do you sometimes, when you hear the news or see what's going on around, you feel like, what am I doing here? You know what? My wife comments all the time when she sees news or hears news, she says, I want out of here. I want away from all of this stuff that's going on. I'm ready. You know, I'm ready to go. Regardless of what's going to happen, I'm ready. And that's the way we should feel. We're strangers here. You know, there's a song, Slim Whitman, I think, says, I'm a pilgrim and I'm a stranger. I must tarry but a while. That's it. We're going to tarry only a while. You know, and then it's going to be the coming with a new world eventually. We're going to live with him for a while, and then we're going to have a new world. And I can't even fathom what it's going to be like. It's just hard and impossible for me to even fathom that. What is our goal? I think our goal is we're looking for that city that whose builder and maker is Yahweh. That is our goal, that new city, that new Jerusalem, to be with him. I left out... Oh, you got something? Go ahead. I'm going to go back. I'm going to regress, but you got something to say? Go ahead.
Well,
I left out verse 3. I left it out to press a point. The worlds framed by Elohim, we understand or perceive to be with our spiritual intelligence the fact of the world's creation by Yahweh. Though we neither see Him nor the act of creation as described in Genesis. We don't even see it.
Right.
We don't see it. The natural world could not, without revelation, teach us this truth. They couldn't do it. Though it confirms the truth by faith, as stated in Romans 1:20. And I one other thing I have to mention. Who is missing from this hall of faith from Genesis? Adam. Adam is missing. Is it Adam because he was the first to fall into sin, by which sin entered the world? I don't know. But he's not listed among the hall of faith. It's sort of a statement, yet it's a question that I don't know if we're going to be able to answer that until we get to the other side, and he'll give us understanding of why. But he's not there for some unknown reason. And I never even thought of that before I started studying this. And I've read this hundreds of times, but I never saw that. So I do get something out of it, even when I'm studying. I get out more out of it usually when somebody else studies and teaches. So anyhow, that's what I have on the first 10 verses, and certainly it is by faith.
Everybody named in the first 10 verses is in the messianic line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it is the seed. Abel is the seed of the woman. Abel was the seed of the woman. Seth was the seed of the woman. Enoch was the seed of the woman. Noah, seed of the woman. When you move on, the first one that you see that's not actually in the messianic line is Yosef and Moshe, but everyone else in this whole lineup is pretty much in the messianic line. So I think that's where the whole thing is coming from. Either in his physical line or in his spiritual line, because we see Samuel and other. Yosef is obviously in his spiritual line.
Well, yeah, in the spiritual line, because both Yosef and Moses are types of the Messiah.
Right.
So they fit that same pattern then, just on a different level.
Camilla on Peltok here had an observation talking about Adam. And is it because perhaps Adam went from the garden and not toward it?
Sure. Sure. Sounds good to me. Yeah. Better than Bill in only a couple of three words. I mean, we had to listen to him for 20 minutes. We got it from Camilla in about half a line. That's great. And that, by the way, corresponds right back to the Torah portion for today where Abram was going away from God and then he was coming back towards him. Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
In the sense, once Adam was out of the garden, he couldn't go back in. He could look and see it, but he could not go into it.
All he could see was that flaming sword.
That flaming sword, that's all he could see. That sword was there. He couldn't even see.
Yeah. You mentioned the ex nihilo creation. Things that we see were not made with things that we can see. Okay? Things that are seen are not made with those things which do appear. In other words, like Colossians 1:16 and 17 say, by his word were they created by him and for him. He spoke and they came into existence from nothing. At least from nothing as far as our standpoint is. Yeah. So, faith is the substance of things of hope for, evidence of things not seen. You know, we do some really silly things to the outside world. They seem silly. We do some really silly things in faith. You know, turn down excellent jobs because they're just not what Yahweh wants you to do. Or what?
Because I'm not motivated by money.
Or because you're not motivated by money. There are just some things that would seem nonsensical to the average person. Why didn't you do that? You know? Or why did you do that? That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Well, because Yahweh impressed on my heart that that's what I ought to do. Mm-hmm. Oh, are you crazy? What a stupid thing to do. You know? I mean, I've done a lot of seemingly stupid things in my life. I'll tell you what. Economically, stupid things I've done in my life. But I've done them because I felt, I wanted to do it the way that I did it. You know? And if I had done any of those things differently, I wouldn't be where I am today. And I'm in a pretty good place. You know? I might be very well to do, but I would probably have lost my family. You know, which would have been much worse. It would not have been worth the money. You know, I mean, there are things like that. We do things by what Yah impresses us to do, and as long as we do stupid things. They look stupid to the people on the outside. They just don't understand. But God, but Elohim uses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. So, anyway, that's all I got for now.
No way.
Without faith, it is impossible to please him in verse 6. For he that cometh to Elohim must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. That verse illustrates verse 5. Enoch says, by faith Enoch was translated that he should not see death, and was not found because Elohim had translated him, for before his translation he had this testimony that he pleased Elohim. Without faith it is impossible to please him. Okay? So the verse 6 is an amplification of what we saw in verse 5. Okay? By faith Noah. Noah believed and endured 120 years of ridicule. Bill touched on it. By his pagan neighbors for his faith, which moved them to do the do the seemingly ridiculous. I mean, excuse me, Noah, it hasn't even rained in history. We get dew that settles on the ground, and that's where we get our water from. And they didn't even know what rain was. And Noah's saying, well, I'm building this boat because Elohim has told me that he's going to make it rain. And they go, what? What's that? I don't even know what that is. Well, Elohim has told me that he's going to make it rain. And you better turn to him, or he's going to make it rain on you. And it's going to be above the mountains, and you're not going to be able to tread water that long. Bill Cosby, how long can you tread water? Okay, I mean, it's 120 years he put up with people's crap for 120 years because he believed Elohim.
It truly was the perfect storm.
Yeah, it was the perfect storm, absolutely. Abraham placed his faith in a promise that he never saw in this life. He never saw it. As we were talking before, he owned property, but he lived in tents. He was looking for that city that had foundations that was built by Yahweh himself. That's what he was looking for. He didn't want to live anywhere else. He wanted to live where Yahweh wanted him. Go for it.
Also on that verse where it says he was called out to a place he was to receive, as Mark said, he'd never seen it. He went out not knowing where he was going. Right. You know, a lot of times we get the question of when it's time to go, where do we go? It didn't matter to Abraham. We just know that wherever he takes us, it'll be the right place. We don't need to know where we're going. We just need to know the one who's getting us there.
Never saw the city that he was looking for until the day he died. The day he died, he got to look at it. Okay? Yeah, you're going to be coming back with it. It's pretty cool.
I think that's all we have. The only thing I can say is this whole lesson was built on faith, because that's what it's about, for trusting Him by faith.
Amen. Amen. Thanks, folks, for coming and joining with us in Pal Talk. We have like about 10 people in the room here with us physically, and then we got y'all. And it was really good to have you. Just a reminder, tomorrow, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it's in the banner, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we're going to have a Shavuot teaching. It's going to be very loose, laid back, looking for questions and comments all throughout. All you got to do, we want you to come in and join us. If you come in and join us, be willing and ready to raise your hand, and we'll let you get in questions and comments. And that's about that. We'll be in about 3 o'clock, and we're going to hang around till about 5:30, not later than 5:30, and then we're going to have a fellowship meal here, and we'll look forward to seeing you. Shabbat Shalom, and we'll see you tomorrow for another Shabbat Shalom. And if we don't, Chag Sameach.